to the fourth episode of TV Cream Countdown, the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments! I, Davros, creator of the Daleks, intend to begin this introductory section by at first talking in a quiet, measured manner as I calmly sequence in an audio trail foreshadowing the rest of this podcast.
And you, Mr. Grenville, has your wife come back from her sisters yet?
I'm Matthew Rudd, host of Forgotten 80s on Absolute 80s.
In at number 10, it's the Game of Rassilon.
I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. I guess she'll die.
But now, as I contemplate the glories to come, and the notion of merely pressing a button, because there's always a button to unleash the full devastation of this TV cream transmission, I will begin speaking in increasingly agitated tones, tones that as I continue further, become louder and louder until I talk myself into a frenzy, and now I'm screaming for no adequate reason! I shall now press the button. Apologies, that was for my recliner. It is this button.
Our thanks there to Davros. So, at number 20...
I'm Matthew Rudd, host of Forgotten 80s on Absolute 80s. I like the 80s, you see. And that was my era of Doctor Who. You know, when you had Peter Davison, the wet vet, fighting the Ergon or the Zeraphin, or escaping from the Master's recursive reality trap on Castro Valva. Or how about that dandy and a clown, Colin Baker, cowering from vervoids in Professor Lasky's hydroponics centre, or thwarting the Cybermen's plan to change history by crashing Halley's Comet into Earth and obliterating it before it can bring about the demise of their original homeworld, Mondas, while Band-Aid was still holding on to their Christmas number one slot. Actually, I don't know anything about Doctor Who, but that's the fate of a jobbing radio DJ. I go where the work is and pretend to give a toss. Away from Absolute, one week I might be covering for Darren Spence on Magic 999. The next, I'm reading this out for TV Cream, safe in the knowledge I'll get no cash for it, and there'll be a joke coming up about how I like to sequence in a long song during my set so I can fit in a poo break. That said, I do have some affinity with this bit of the podcast because it's about the oral delights found in Doctor Who. The show's very first episode, which went out when Jerry and the Pacemakers were at number one with You'll Never Walk Alone, having knocked off John Smith and the Common Men's He Teaches Me to Throb, set the standard for audio heroics to come. I'm talking about the bit when Ian and Barbara first come across the TARDIS and, oh, we're there now. It's kind of a brilliant, shimmery baseline to madness, isn't it? But even that's topped by the full-on wig-out of the TARDIS dematerialising at the end of the episode. Let me just set the coordinates. There we go. How to describe this? The greatest ever sound effect in the whole of British television. Well, aside from the noise that accompanied the Name That Tune rotating wheel. Double! Double! I guess the TARDIS effect is like an audio recording of a migraine raging inside God's head. Not to be confused with the sound of the inside of Doctor Who's head, of course, which, let me fade that up, goes like this.
Watch out for those phagocytes! Those phagocytes! Those phagocytes!
It's remarkable, actually, how many of the early sound effects were just bang on. Like this, the Dalek Death Ray. And if I get this one up on the deck, you know exactly where we are, right? About to jump out on some peephole-trousered thals and demand their lunch money. But uh-oh, some little Dalek babies are hatching out. To fade down that noise, do I have the right? One of the most lavish and layered soundscapes ever was served up for Dr. John Pertwee's visit to Metabilis 3. Oh yes, Matt Smith may go Metabilis, but good old Matt Rudd here gets it spot on with Metabilis, because that's the kind of diligent broadcaster I am. Ask anyone who listens to independent radio anywhere along the catchment area of the M62. And I should say, I'm very happy to pick up shifts and have some good ideas for regular phone-ins. But what of the 1980s, my era? Obviously, I'm a big fan of Megloss's dodecahedron energy beams. Which has the cadence of my Kia Picanto, starting up at 4 a.m. when I'm doing breakfast deps. Now, you'll have heard a lot of the Five Doctors' Dark Tower horn blowing in this podcast already, so I'll skip that. But I'm also partial to the whole soundscape accompanying the Rastan Warrior Robot Cyber Massacre, which mashes together some excellent cyber groans, Peter Howell's clanky incidental music, and the Billy Whiz-like whooshes of said unitard-clad killing machine. However, for the greatest sound effect in the whole of 1980s Doctor Who, we turn to the time when Joe Dolci was celebrating his second week at number one with Shut Up Your Face.
It's a not so bad, it's a nicer place.
The broadcast of Logopolis, I don't know how that's pronounced, episode one. Let's hear it now. Yes, the cloister bell. Only ever sounded in times of dire peril, or as a sign that I, Matthew Rudd, am about to clock off and hand over to the next guy, who I can just see settling into his adjacent booth here in the TV Cream podcast studio. As for me, I'm off to walk the Bassetts, but not before I grab this paper and head off for a quick 5 minutes of contemplation. After all, might as well do it on company time, yeah? Doctor Who? Doctor Pooh, more like.
Number 19, Grade Expectations.
The biggest mistake Michael Grade made while controller of BBC One in the 1980s was over Doctor Who. He should have cancelled it outright. Had he done this, instead of merely ordering the show off the air for 18 months, not only would the nation have been spared the further self-immolation of a once great TV institution, but chances are that institution would have returned to our screens a lot sooner. Perhaps, almost certainly, and maybe without question, like this. February 1985. Michael Grade announces he is axing Doctor Who. Colin Baker, who has played the Doctor on screen for just 11 months, describes Mr. Grade as a tawdry, bellicose toad. March 1985. The final episode of Doctor Who ends with the TARDIS materialising in a market square in the East End of London and being requisitioned by the GLC in a guest appearance by Ken Livingstone. October 1985. An unofficial Doctor Who stage musical, produced by John Nathan Turner and starring Colin Baker, Kenny Lynch and Sandra Dickinson, closes after just 6 nights due to poor ticket sales. March 1986. 1 year on from the final episode, an opinion poll finds that just 14% of the public would like to see Doctor Who back on television, while 66% think the most recent actor to play the part was Tom Baker. June 1987. A Doctor Who fan stands against Margaret Thatcher in the general election and polls 4 votes. He is later arrested for urinating against the side of a BBC outside broadcast van. November 1988. Controversy marks Doctor Who's 25th anniversary when John Pertwee appears on Wogan and calls Michael Grade an arsehole with braces. February 1991. Phil Redmond announces that if Mersey Television wins the ITV franchise for the North West, he will bring back Doctor Who and make him, quote, a Scouser with a cheeky grin and 2 hearts of gold. October 1991, Phil Redmond fails to win the ITV franchise for the North West. April 1992, Labour wins the general election, and newly appointed Secretary of State for Culture, Ken Livingstone, says it would be smashing to see Doctor Who back on screens. He hopes the BBC will mark the show's 30th anniversary with a glorious reunion of space-time travellers and baddies. November 1993. A glittering 90-minute Doctor Who 30th anniversary adventure is broadcast on BBC One, starring all the surviving Doctors, except Colin Baker, plus special guests Ian McShane, Louise Lombard, Jason Donovan and Carol Barnes. Entitled Bigger on the Inside, written by Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenet and produced by Michael Wearing, it is a critical and commercial hit. BBC One controller Alan Yentob confirms a new series of Doctor Who will start filming next year. February 1994. Casting begins for a new Doctor Who, with Neil Pearson, Craig McLaughlin, Rick Mayall and Normski among the favourites. April 1994. The new Doctor Who is revealed to be Robert Lindsay. He tells the press, "I can't wait to be off around the galaxy, though I'm sure I'll be dropping in on Tooting." May 1994, Colin Baker tells the press he has no intention of returning to the show to record a regeneration sequence, declaring he would rather get zapped by a Dalek than work for the BBC again. June 1994, former Channel 4 head of films David Rose is confirmed as executive producer of the new series of Doctor Who. Scripts have been commissioned from, amongst others, Peter Flannery, Dennis Potter, Alan Bleasdale, Neil Gaiman, and Stephen Fry. July 1994, Charlotte Coleman is announced as the new Doctor Who companion. October 1994, the Pet Shop Boys confirm they have produced a new version of the Doctor Who theme. November 1994, guest stars for the new series include Sir John Gielgud, Helen Mirren, Michael Palin, Philip Schofield, and, in a surprise cameo role, Leader of the Opposition, Michael Heseltine. January 1995. The new series of Doctor Who is hailed as the biggest and best yet by BBC Director General Michael Grade.
Number 18. Captain Jack Takes a Dive.
Time and space.
Nowadays, we're used to gaps the length of entire seasons of Doogie Howser MD in the middle of series of Doctor Who, though admittedly most people probably wish that we weren't. When a troublesome 2-week gap was plonked into the middle of David Tennant's second run, however, this was a whole new phenomenon, and the production team's response to being shunted aside to make way for the Eurovision Song Contest was to panic and replace the Next Time trailer for 42, which, let's face it, would have had a hard time convincing anyone to tune in next time anyway, with a montage of highlights to come from what had become by default the second half of the series. After quick cut clippage of your scarecrows, your Saxons and your sodding weeping angels came what was clearly intended to be the real viewer interest maintaining money shot, TV's John Barrowman leaping at the TARDIS in slow motion shouting, "As trailers go, it wasn't exactly the original 1975 trailer for Jaws. It's not even..."
"The EastEnders are coming to BBC One."
And to make matters worse, it was just something that wouldn't even be shown for over 2 months anyway. What's more, confusingly, it was less of a pointer towards things to come in Doctor Who than it was a resolution to Torchwood's first series cliffhanger, which had seen a hand-in-jar-looking Captain Jack taking a Hanna-Barbera-style dash towards a faint TARDIS noise somewhere in the distance, much to the consternation of its assembled omnisexual chums. Still, Utopia, when it finally arrived, was a great episode, and anyway, it was better than any of those purpose-free fan-made trailers you find all over YouTube.
Number 17. Is this the planet Shepherd's Bush?
Hello?
Well, that was a textbook nice, pleasant, open hello, but the man delivering it is too often described as the most abrasive Doctor Who of them all. And while other constituents of this TV Cream podcast are most certainly of that opinion...
I suppose you mean me.
The fact of the matter is, when it comes in particular to Colin Baker's Doctor Who-related appearances outside the confines of Doctor Who, well, we're presented with a masterclass of sheer affability.
Oh, you don't have to answer. No, I'm very happy to answer it, and in fact my opinions have mellowed over the years. I actually have no strong axe to grind against Michael Gray. He was a very honest man, and I happen to see most of the things he does with television and agree with him wholeheartedly.
So it's just plain wrong to label Colin Baker the grumpiest Doctor ever. No, someone else has to take that dubious honour on the chin. The Mr. Chin.
My dear Mr. Chin, if I could leave, I would. If only to get away from people like you.
Doctor!
And your petty obsessions!
The fact of the matter is, Colin Baker isn't even the grumpiest Colin Baker.
Colin Baker, for Thames News, Westminster. Soaked with cold feet, a aching heart, married, several children, pissed off, really dreadfully pissed off.
Colin's joie de vivre is hardly surprising. He was the first out and proud Doctor Who fan to be cast in the role.
It's one of those sort of parts that you never actually think you're going to be the one who's ever going to be Doctor Who.
Granted, he perhaps doesn't quite measure up to today's superfan in residence, the type who in the 1970s were running their own international Doctor Who fan club, or in the 1990s contributing fanfic to the Virgin book series, as well as tossing off the odd pseudonymous offering to the publisher's parallel range of adult novels. But Colin really is one of us, and that's perhaps part of the reason why he always tries to imbue any personal appearance with an extra touch of doctorishness. Like Peter Capaldi twiddling his lapels on live TV, Colin always has a bit of business.
Is this the planet Shepherd's Bush?
It is indeed, sir.
That was, of course, his sublime appearance on Wogan in 1986, when not only did he help Terry out of a bit of a fix with the Mandrills.
What have you done with Doctor Who? And who are you?
He was also quite happy to help propagate a certain long-running BBC in-joke that throughout the 80s proved as verdant as Shepherd's Bush Green itself.
You're not scared of monsters, are you?
No! I've been to the BBC canteen.
Colin's always been a good company man, someone who's willing to pop up on other shows as a metaphorical spear carrier when required.
You have been watching Roland Rat, the series, and now... back to BBC One for Doctor Who, the series.
Also a reliably amusing chat show guest, Colin learnt from the very best. Shortly after being cast in the role, he was invited to come and study at the foot of the master.
Oh, my dear Doctor, you have been naive.
No, not you, the other master. Russell Harty.
Why are you dressed like that?
You're a bit public schooler, though.
I mean, without being too critical, Doctor Who is a little bit like a homemade loaf.
Star Wars again.
In addition to Russell's warm yet incisive questioning style, it's safe to assume that once the evening's edition of Harty wrapped, the former Giggleswick schoolmaster gave Colin some after-hours tutoring in the delicate art of weaving an interview within, outside and, to some extent, behind the latitudes of both fact and fiction. Much as Russell himself had done that time he met the cast of Upstairs Downstairs.
You're called Gareth Hunt, aren't
yes.
you? Gareth is an actor's name. Is it your real name?
Yes, Bellamy was self-made. Are we talking about Bellamy or David Langton? Me?
I think let's talk a bit about David Langton, since you've overwhelmed him with your Bellamy. When you go home at night, you as your real self, and go home, do you ever have to do for yourself? But does he represent the new school in reality, in real life?
In the 30s, that period, yes.
No, but I mean in the 1970s. In real life, where do you come from?
I come from Leeds.
Hear how Colin then deploys the same elegant style of segue during this encounter on an episode of Blue Peter.
Doctor? Oh, Doctor. Welcome back to Blue Peter.
Janet Ellis of the planet Earth, how nice to see you. I've come back to Earth specially because I have to go and find a barber, you see.
Colin is a man who has always fretted about doing right by Doctor Who, to the point of nitpicking his own sublime performance during the regeneration scene in the caves of Androzani.
I just wish I hadn't blinked. There was a little blink in there which we could have done without. But
and he was always willing to take on new skills to make sure he could really fit the various briefs the show threw at him.
Matthew, Robinson, the director, was great fun to work with and very creative. In the clip you've just seen, he's the one who taught me how to play the organ, because the notes were genuine, folks. I really did play the Bach thingamy, whatever it was.
Oh, and just to be clear, in using the word briefs, I'm not trying to set up a cheap joke about Colin's pants or knickers or shibboleths or Y-fronts or whatever you want to call them.
I don't think shibboleths mean pants. Are you sure about that?
Yes, shibboleths. It's like a posh word for knickers. But we digress. And so TV Cream gives a proud salute and a twiddle of the lapels to Colin Baker, the man who in 1987 was bold enough to go on Secrets Out to confess in front of the Grange Hill cast, including Ant Jones, about his own particular proclivity.
I collect inanimate cats.
And who, from his very first day on Doctor Who, did his best to safeguard one of the core tenets of the show. Here's Jonathan Turner to explain that one.
I'll tell you a little story about the opening credits. The composite at the beginning of Colin is a series of still photographs so that he smiles in, you know, as the slight head turn and he smiles as the face is coming forward. And originally we toyed with the idea of Colin winking. So we did a whole sequence of shots with Colin doing a quarter wink, a half wink, a three-quarter wink, and so on. And when those were pieced together, he happened to have changed his mouth expressions slightly on each shot, so that as he winked, he did that.
And when J&T says he did that, he means Colin mouthed one specific phrase.
Is shibboleths a posh word for knickers?
Yeah, you see, shibboleths. Thank you, Colin. Yet another reason to give thanks to Colin Baker, who, by the way, asked us to point out that he's no relation to Pip and Jane.
No relation whatsoever, I promise. I said I'd say that, Pip and Jane, okay?
Number 16. What would Who do?
Regeneration is a funny thing, isn't it? And it's a simple enough premise.
He is a Time Lord. I will give the process a little push and the cells will regenerate. He will become a new man.
And that's an Oriental stereotype who knows what he's talking about. Whoever he is.
Thank you. That makes everything quite clear.
Well, perhaps not that simple after all. It doesn't seem to be just a question of a wee change of face.
Little snip here, a little snip there, snip snip.
We get a new body, a new face, but that's not meant to be all.
And it will shake up the brain cells a little. You may find his behaviour somewhat erratic.
They've all done it, though in William Hartnell's case it seemed to largely involve lying on the floor like a bag of rags before an extreme close-up.
Doctor! Help us!
No, leave it!
Shame, because it would have been nice to have got a bit more.
It's a pity! Mm-hmm.
Still, the bit about the face was rather hammered home as time went on.
Oh, he's too old! But he's too fat, isn't he? No, he's too thin! Yes, that one's too young! Oh, no, that won't do at all!
Then it got a bit melodramatic.
I had to face my fear, Sarah. I had to face my fear.
Then it got a bit tonto.
Watch.
He was the doctor all the time.
You cannot be serious!
No, honestly. Back to melodrama.
I might regenerate. I don't know.
It feels different this time.
Mind you, Perry wobbling over him at the time probably didn't help his concentration.
Splendid girl, and so helpful.
Well, in fact, the rest of that scene probably didn't help either.
Can you hear me? Open your mouth. You must drink this.
Well, crap double entendres aside, the premise, beyond recasting, is that it rejuvenates the mind as well as the body.
The Doctor can be young and strong. So can I. The Master Reborn.
All the bits swapped round.
New teeth. That's weird.
But the doctors never seem to mind, and somehow it all works out.
Well, nothing's perfect.
It doesn't seem to slow them down for long.
Not fit? Of course I'm fit. All systems go.
Well, most of them. But despite all the mucking about and the trauma, they still remember names and big sums and stuff.
This ridiculous!
New face, character, all good. Oh, occasionally and unfortunately, new jackets too. But let's get down to the brass tacks of pointless and uninformed speculation, which is, after all, what we're here for. And now let's think of a scenario and apply the question, what would who do? What would a different doctor do in another doctor's place? And for that, we can think of no better scenario than this.
I'm the Doctor. I'm a Time Lord. I'm from the planet Gallifrey in the constellation of Casterbarus. I'm 903 years old, and I'm the man who's going to save your lives and all 6 billion people on the planet below.
Mm-hmm. So David Tennant, Doctor, promises the wacky crowd of misfits and comedy reliefs in Voyage of the Damned that he'll save them all. Well, that's despite the fact that this is the intergalactic equivalent of the Kiss of the Black Widow. Well, let's ponder what other doctors might have done in his place. Davison, we suggest, would implore them. Baker would chide them. Petwee would scold them. And Hartnell would just have bloody well left them behind.
Brilliant.
Pointless exercise? Well, obviously. But what's the point of Doctor Who if you can't sit around talking shite about it? I mean, after all, we've been doing it for 50 years now. So here's a game for all the family to play at Christmas. Take a scenario from popular children's television programme Doctor Who, then consider the infinite possibilities provided by the alternatives, acting in that Doctor's place. It's easy to do, especially considering David Tennant will gift you the obvious outcome for the rest of the characters in his scenario. They'll all die.
I don't want to go.
Oh, geez, peace. Fast lane, have heart, have money. Ain't nobody
smiling. Ain't nothing funny. Race the risk, raise the profit. Number 15.
You will be the first.
When the lost 1967 story The Tomb of the Cybermen was returned to the BBC archives in 1992, Doctor Who had been off the air for over 2 years. And as the fans didn't really have much else to talk about, the reaction was a lot more cynical than you might have expected. On the plus side, the sudden availability of the visuals meant that a lot of fan luminaries who claimed to fondly remember it went mysteriously and hilariously quiet when it emerged that what was seen on screen didn't quite match up with the scenes that they'd made up in their own heads. On the other hand, however, there was the ugly spectacle of fans falling over themselves to shout the loudest about how it just wasn't as good as people had claimed in the intervening years. Although it was an embarrassing example of poorly made television that they needed to bother finding again, well, you had to really push the boat out to make yourself the centre of attention in those days. Anyway, some of them were just unable to see the mechanics of television production of yesteryear in context. Others were reacting with tongue very much in cheek against a long-standing fan orthodoxy, but the majority were tripping over each other in their quest to become fandom's equivalent of Roland Barthes, even though their analysis was more worthy of Tony Parsons. This isn't to say that there aren't some frankly ridiculous bits in The Tomb of the Cybermen. If you can get past the cyber controller dummy's head flying off when it gets flung across the room, the crewman shouts,
"No, wait a minute! Look!"
Viner saying, "You're getting in my way to Victoria's breasts," and Cleek in general without smirking, "You're doing better than the rest of us," but really, it's no better or no worse than you'd expect from a TV show that was made to be shown once several decades ago. Well, apart from one bit. During a particularly tense moment, when the Cybermen are revealing their admittedly rather credulity-stretching plans to the trapped archaeological party, the controller explains that they will be made into Cybermen.
You will be the first.
Then, somewhere between the 70s soul backing singer and one of the ones looking over Marlowe's shoulder in The Wire, one of his subordinates points to Professor Parry from safely behind his leader and intones,
"And you will be the next."
Then there's a pause, and then, and only then, do the assembled cast remember that they're supposed to be struggling with each other. Rumours that the original script contains the crossed out lines,
"And you will be the one after that,"
and
"We'll do you a week next Tuesday,"
sadly cannot be confirmed.
Come on. Number 14. When Doctor Who sings.
Oh no, you are going to sing.
Well, yes, I am.
Should warn you that in about 3 minutes' time, you'll be hearing more of Sixth Doctor Who Colin Baker, in character, attempting to wrap his tonsils around a Victorian party piece. In the meantime, however, let's hear something a bit more full-throated. That's the Dr. John Pertwee at the start of the 1970 story Inferno, driving along, bellowing the Duke of Mantua's canzoni from the opening of Act 3 of Verdi's opera Rigoletto. Unmatched among his fellow doctors when it came to bursting into song at delightful, if spurious, moments, Pertwee's pipes could wow an audience no matter what the material. Just listen to the reaction in this clip from the 1971 story, Terror of the Autons.
I don't want to set the world on fire.
No manners, but what a critic.
A ham-fisted bun vendor.
Charming. There weren't just solo efforts either. Here he is, trying to start a sing-along.
Shine on, Martian moons up in the sky. Join in, Liz, come on. Shine on.
Trying and failing. But we were all fools for not taking his tessitura more seriously. Pertwee remains the closest we've come to what would be the glorious prospect of a proper, full-time singing doctor. The part is perfect for someone who warbles at the flimsiest provocation. Pertwee recorded whole albums of the stuff.
I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. I guess she'll die.
Now, why a song and dance man wasn't considered for the role from the outset is a mystery. One person who would know the answer is Doctor Who's first producer, Verity Lambert. But there's a problem.
She's dead, of course.
Instead, we must make do with this.
Nothing is so good, it lasts eternally. Perfect situations must go wrong.
Song and dance man John Barrowman turning in a rather persuasive version of I Know Him So Well, but who, alas, didn't grace any of his appearances in Doctor Who with a sudden gay gavotte or even a burst of the Marrow Song.
Oh, what a beauty! I've never seen one as big as that before.
There are precious other examples of doctors being moved to a quick trill, scat, or even a whistle. Sometimes we've seen them display a bit of musical precocity. The Sixth Doctor essaying a burst of J.S. Bach on his organ. The Fifth Doctor plucking a harp. The Seventh Doctor playing the spoons. But of larynx-stretching workouts, not a sign. Perhaps this isn't a bad thing, though. Peter Davison certainly struggled to hit those high notes in Button Moon.
After Button Moon, you follow Mr. Spoon.
While Tom Baker struggles even as a British telecom text message service set to a disco beat.
Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing. Oh yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night. You really got me.
Back then to Colin Baker. Five words that ought to steal even the flintiest of souls. Here he is, in one of those unofficial Doctor Who talking books, attempting that last refuge of the novelty performer, a pastiche of Gilbert and Sullivan's Model Major General.
I am the very model of a Gallifreyan buccaneer. I've information on all things a Gallifreyan holds, must dear. I've linked it to the matrix to his excitonic circuitry. I understand dimensional and relative chronometry.
Oh, dear.
I'm very well acquainted, too, with matters of the Capitol. I give you a verse and chapter on Panopticonian protocol. I've been into the Death Zone and I play the game of Rassilon.
Rassilon? 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 Aha!
With pestilential monsters that I got a lot of hassle from.
With pestilential monsters that he got a lot of hassle from. With pestilential monsters that he got a lot of hassle from. With pestilential monsters that he got a lot of hassle from.
Enough! My buccaneers can't take any more. Oh, to hear again a restorative burst of Pertwee, be it swapping rubatos with Frankie Howard in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, all lisping through the runaway train. Alas, the chance of a new tune from John is impossible. Why?
She's dead, of course.
Number 13. Has your wife come back from her sister's yet?
Now, as I've told you, this is not going to be a sermon. But all the same, I do beg of you to listen carefully.
And when the master requests your attention, you must obey. Not so much because of his mesmeric mendacity, but because, when played by Roger Delgado, he's simply the most charming Doctor Who baddie of all time, the emollient Richard Devere to the Third Doctor's jagged Audrey Forbes Hamilton, which incidentally makes Joe Margery, Benton Brabinger, and the Brigadier Mrs. Pooh.
It's true. I am ashamed to hold up my head in the carapidist.
In 1971, we were given a perfect shop window onto the dastard's diorama of dashing charm. Five-part adventure The Daemons saw him ditch his Barry Grant during their Laluth years Nehru jacket in exchange for a dog collar and a pair of thick bins as he took on the guise of village vicar, the Reverend Magister.
Now, as you know, I am a newcomer among you, and yet already I feel that I know you all.
And it's here he delivers one of the most delicately beautiful villain speeches ever composed for Doctor Who. Forget that time he hailed
peoples of the universe.
It's the peoples of this small hamlet, Devil's End, he intends to wrangle. Peoples, if indeed that is the right grammar here, with provincial concerns. Lives full of little dramas, patched over by tiny euphemisms. The masters lifted the Tupperware lid on their domestic shame and noted it all down.
For instance, you, Mr. Thorpe, are you still padding the grocery bills of a local gentry?
What you on about? That slander.
No, don't deny it, I know.
This, despite the fact he's a super space villain with all the cosmos to mess around him. Can you imagine Omega bothering with that?
Be silent!
You see, there's no need for shouting. Not when some delicately placed barbs will do quite nicely.
And you, Charlie, how's your conscience? Do you think you'll manage to balance the post office books in time?
But let's cut in here for a moment more, because just to underscore our point, try and imagine how ploddingly dull this lovely stuff would be if delivered by one of the Doctor's more thunderous foes.
And you, Mr. Grenville, has your wife come back from her sister's yet? Will she ever come back, do you suppose?
Yes, that's what it sounds like through the boring modulator. So here's the remainder as it should be heard.
No, please do not be angry with me. I assure you that I'm on your side. Now listen, if you do what I say, you can all of you get whatever you want in this world, when you want it, if you listen to me.
Quite masterly.
Number 12. Cyber Twats.
Popular children's television programme Doctor Who is about one thing.
Monsters.
Yeah, well, all right, about the Doctor. But then it's all about
monsters.
So they'd better be good ones. To that end, there's certainly plenty of them.
Daleks and Sontarans, Cybermen!
Well, let's just draw a discreet veil for the moment over the Sontarans, who we've never found particularly scary, looking as they do like Brian Blessed's just come through a house fire. So in the Great Hall of Monsters, we can't really avoid the fact that the Daleks are the kiddies, even if the new ones do look a bit like Davros's mutated Fred the Home Pride Man.
There's something new from Home Pride.
But even the Mighty Morphin Power Daleks are pretty much the same Daleks they've always been. Cybermen, however, well, that's a different matter. And no other monster has been mocked about quite so much as the cyber twats. Perhaps the era of tall and fat Cybermen, that is to say, the 80s, provided a justifiable motivation for a radically new look. But then the mythology has changed too. No longer escapees from Mondas or in the deep freeze on Telos, now they originate from Pete's world. But are they better? Do the disco Cybermen stand up in the scary states to the body stocking or bako foil Cybermen of the old series? Let's see.
You belong to us.
Destroy them! Destroy them at once!
Emergency, all units will converge on the Torchwood Tower.
Excellent.
Cybermen will investigate.
Capture them alive. They must be interrogated first.
Behold, I am risen. Witness me, mankind. A cyber king of all.
Well, so you see the problem. Of old, the Cybermen were all about destroying and annihilating and ting. Doubtless the new Cybermen would be thrilled to sing all the old songs, but unfortunately, it all comes across wee bit crap. We could sum up what's not scary about the new Cybermen with this.
My people, why do they not rejoice?
You see, that statement from the demented outing of a Cyber King, yes, we know, it demonstrates everything that's not scary about the new lot. I mean, essentially, it's hard to sound too menacing when you keep saying you're just trying to do folk a nice wee favour, as if conquering the human race was like settling us all down with juice and a biscuit. And the manifestation of the supposed evil mindermast of a creator, John Lumick, well, that didn't help much either.
Excellence! Then let's begin!
How you going, Dave?
But the old Cybermen were scary because they would really rather just have preferred to slaughter the lot of us. And however you sell it, that's not a particularly comforting thought.
You shall be like us!
Basically, it's just time the Cybermen got back with the programme and delivered more of this.
And at number 11, the father of fandom.
Oh, feeling quite tense, really. I've just arrived at the house of a very important man in the history of Doctor Who. He's written a couple of books about his contribution to Who. I suppose I should just get on with it and knock on the door.
I'm Keith Miller. Some people call me the Space Cowboy. Some call me the Gangster of Love.
Well, you may not know it, but we are all in the Keith Miller Band, and this is Keith. He's the man who first laid down the beat of what it means to be a Doctor Who fan, a Whovian, a Whoist, a Whoer. And we are currently sitting in the great man's family room. To our left, his bookshelf is wheezing and groaning under the strain of Peter Haining's triptych of A Celebration, The Key to Time, and the other one he did, the Doctor Who file. And we can also spot James Stammers, Walker, Howes, Bentham, Gillett, and other agreeable Time Lord-focused tomes. Over to our right. Well, to our right is a full-size Dalek, one that's observable from the street outside, and one that, while we're here, draws in a comedian pounding the streets trying to promote a Doctor Who-themed stand-up show he's performing. We're in Edinburgh, by the way, at the height of Fringe season. With the comedian slash fan duly dispatched by the Millers, this becomes just another moment of Who's synchronicity that seems to happen to Keith these days. But back in the early 1970s, it was an active desire to collide with his favourite show that motivated the young and painfully shy Miller to set up and run the first proper Doctor Who fan club.
So I wrote one letter to the BBC saying, is there a Doctor Who fan club? And Sarah Newman wrote back and said, yes, there is. Here's the address.
Sarah Newman being the secretary of the then Doctor Who producer Barry Letts. But we'll come back to her later.
I wrote to Graham Tattersall, who was doing the fan club at that time. And there was no reply. So the second letter I had written to Sarah Newman, saying, I've tried to contact this guy, but just not getting anywhere. If he doesn't want to do the fan club anymore, which is what I expect is happening, then I'll be quite happy to take it over. So there was a pause of about a week. Then I got the letter back saying, you're quite right, Graham Tattersall doesn't want to do it anymore, and we're quite keen for you to take it over because you sound so enthusiastic.
In the mind of the teenage Keith, being secretary of the official Doctor Who fan club was going to bring him into the orbit of the show's stars.
I don't think I would have carried on with the job if an invitation to actually go down to the BBC wasn't forthcoming quite quickly.
And forthcoming quite quickly it was, as Keith found himself part of a television institution and coming face to face with the stars of Doctor Who in various different states of ocular or actual dress, or indeed undress.
John Pertwee wasn't the realisation that, oh my God, I'm actually in Doctor Who's world. It's when I tripped over Katie Manning and I saw the bottle end glasses for the very first time. I'd never seen them before. And her apologising profusely and saying, I'm blind as a bat, or whatever. And that sort of like took the sting out of turning around and there was John Pertwee, naked apart from a towel, you know, which again was really sort of, good grief, what's going on here?
Although Keith saw Pertwee as an avuncular figure, albeit one who was happy to whip out his tats and criticise whenever Keith's newsletter dared feature any incarnation of the Doctor other than him, Keith's relationship with Tom Baker was altogether different.
I remember the very first meeting with Tom, sitting down in the restaurant, not the canteen, but the restaurant.
Today, it's almost impossible to imagine what it must have been like to be a Doctor Who fan and to sit down opposite Tom Baker and not only have no idea who he is, but have no conception of what sort of Doctor he might be. For Keith, he had to weigh up Tom Baker as if he were, because in fact he was, a complete stranger.
Tom more or less sat and looked at me, and Philip Hinchcliffe was introduced to me and saying stories about the fan club and the monthly newsletter. And Tom was just sort of like taking me in. And there was a few questions asked. Then Tom went to the toilet and then I sort of like relaxed because I knew everybody then. But then Tom had obviously, whilst he'd been in the toilet, been thinking, you know, oh, I'm tired of this. Let's just get to the point. And he actually sort of more or less ran back to the table, sort of like jammed his face in mine and said, who are you? What are you wanting? You know, and I was so taken aback. I wasn't as shy as I had been before, but it was still nerve-wracking. I remember after they had all gone back to start making Genesis of the Daleks, I remember heaving a sigh of relief and Philip saying, well, what do you think? And I went, well, he's very intelligent, isn't he? After that, Tom could basically sort of like take me or leave me. You know.
Let there be oysters. But spool back to the Pertwee era, and there was one relationship that developed between Keith and the Doctor Who production office that seemed to be meaningful on both sides.
Sarah was lovely.
Keith is talking about Sarah Newman. That's Barry Letts' secretary.
She's a hopeless secretary,
says Keith.
But a really, really nice person.
She was also the main point of contact between Keith and the production office, and the two regularly corresponded by telephone and letter.
There was a certain amount of closeness. I mean, when my dad died, you know, she was there to say, look, just, and it wasn't just put the Doctor Who fan club on the back burner. You know, she gave me loads of advice about what to do at school and just to take things easy, and things will change, but you'll get over it.
Dear Keith, I am sorry about your father, and so is everyone here. Actually, my father died at roughly the same age as you are, so I know what it's like. However, I found if I was with people the whole time, you tend to stop feeling so miserable. Take care, and love to your mum. Yours sincerely, Sarah.
I just thought, well, she's, you know, she's English, and this is obviously how English people are.
Most of Keith's communications, though, in his capacity as secretary of the official Doctor Who fan club, were with fellow fans. Again, this was the dark age of Doctor Who, when a devotee could very well go through life believing they were the only hardcore Whovian in existence. Did Keith form an impression of what an average Who fan might be like?
I did have a picture in my mind of who I was dealing with, the demographic that I was dealing with. People won't like me saying this, but Doctor Who is basically a kid's show. And it was going to be kids who, like I said, wanted to know what Katie Manning's favourite flavour of Angel Delight was. That was what I was there to answer and to push information through the club newsletter. I thought I, running the Doctor Who fan club, would be the biggest fan. Well, in fact, no. People would ask me stuff and I thought, good grief, that's going to take ages. Why does the time rotor, when it's idle, go clockwise? I don't know. And where did I find out?
We don't know either. Anyway, over the years, Keith had to deal with the fact that
the fans changed, and I had to change my attitude towards them. Perhaps I was patronising at the beginning. And then the fans, I think, thought that I wasn't knowledgeable enough to carry on in the post.
As well as threatening Keith's status, some fans even felt it permissible to turn up at his house unannounced.
I remember the first time it happened. A guy had hired a car and it was unannounced. And the mum and dad appeared. And my mum said, oh, there's someone at the front door for you. They're from the fan club. It was a real young child with his mum and dad, a wee blonde kid, I remember. Intensely shy, which was quite good because it made me feel really confident. I had a brief conversation on the doorstep and the dad was really apologetic that he hadn't arranged this beforehand. And I invited him in because I'd done my bedroom out with polystyrene roundels. I think there was a sense of responsibility there. I mean, I had more or less made up my mind that I was working for the BBC now. And in those days, every inquiry to the BBC about anything had to have a response. So if somebody appeared on my doorstep, I had to represent the BBC at that point and not just say, this is my private life, go away.
Positioned at the centre of the fandom Hooniverse, the gravitational pull of our Keith dragged in all sorts of weird and wonderful matter. And it was only a matter of time before he found himself set on a collision course with fan politics.
What I didn't realise when I'd taken over the fan club, because it was only my second letter to the BBC, was that there had been other guys who'd been writing to the BBC for a long time, and their noses were put totally out of joint. Stuart Money was one of, if not the biggest, Doctor Who fan.
Stuart was also the founder of John Pertwee's fan club. We don't know what his members were called. Petweenies? However, Stuart represented the other great landmass in the emerging world of Who fandom, and eventually he called for a G8, or rather a Who 3 summit, to take place in Edinburgh.
Your conference has been saved. Now it's up to you and your friends to make sure it's a success.
He said, do you mind if me and John Hudson, my best mate, come up and meet you? And I said, no, fine. So he came up and I met him at the Waverley Station. And we got a taxi back to my house. And on the way past Edinburgh Castle, he pointed up to Edinburgh Castle and said, oh, it looks like the castle in Peldon. And I thought, that's a Doctor Who fan for you. We got to my house and we had a chat and talked about what was coming up in the show and what happened in the show and everything was really nice. And then went back, I decided that I was not nearly as big a fan as, you know, the secretary of the Doctor Who fan club should be. And that was it, you know. The politics had started from that meeting onwards. Fan politics had been born.
And there was another faction bubbling around in the primordial soup of the Whoniverse.
Yeah, the first time I heard the name Peter Capaldi was in a letter from Sarah Newman, a duplicated letter, or a copy of the letter that she had sent to Peter, with Peter saying that he wanted to be the Doctor Who fan club president or whatever. Sarah Newman says, "We've already got one, thank you very much, and here's his address. If you write to him, I'm sure he'll be able to induct you into the fan club," or whatever, and then it was sent off. And that was the first that I'd heard of Peter. Then he got in contact almost immediately, and I think he came, like Stuart Money, he came to the conclusion pretty quickly that my credentials weren't quite as good as they could be, and that he too wanted the Doctor Who fan club. And Peter went one stage further and set up the International Doctor Who fan club. People were setting up fan clubs all over the place. Even Tom said to me, you know, "Well, why can't they set up fan clubs? They can do that if they want." And I was saying, "Yes, they can do that. But why do they want my one?" You know, they didn't want to set up a fan club of their own. They wanted the legend official somewhere in the title. And I was the only one who had that. And that's what they wanted.
With Keith based in Edinburgh and Peter in Bishop Briggs, effectively a suburb of Glasgow, Keith's biggest rival was practically on his own doorstep.
I was quite conscious of the fact that, you know, he was only a train ride away. And it was funny when Sarah said, "Could you just nip across to Glasgow and sort him out for me?" I lay awake for nights thinking, was she being serious? And was I to become Doctor Who's hitman?
Keith Miller's ineffectiveness as an assassin may have ultimately turned out for the best. History, and more importantly, Doctor Who fans, will judge this all in good time.
He seemed like a nice guy.
So what does Keith think of Nice Guy Pete getting the ultimate Whovian gig?
I had actually flown to Jersey for a week's vacation, and we had just got into the hotel, sat down in front of the telly, and when you saw the shot of Peter, the back of his head as he waited to go out onto the stage and for the announcement to be made, I thought, no, it can't be. No, it can't be. And then it was.
Peter Capaldi!
It was quite a moment.
And as Keith recounts his memory of Capaldi's announcement, we realise that, weirdly, Keith Miller, the fan from long ago, is known to and by the new Doctor Who.
That's strange. I never thought about that before. But yeah, you're quite right.
And although Zoe Ball didn't really do more than pay lip service to Peter Capaldi's fan credentials, the powers that be did seem to carry out all of the necessary background checks.
Shortly before the announcement on Sunday, there was a whole batch of my book got sold, all in one batch. And I'm quite sure it was the BBC having a scrutiny just to make sure that there was nothing there that could possibly harm their new star.
Meanwhile, Keith, long retired from Who fandom, found himself ironically thrust back into the spotlight by his erstwhile arch nemesis.
For 4 days, everybody wanted a quote. Everybody wanted an interview. CNN International wanted me to do a live Skype interview. CNN in London wanted me to go into the studio.
With Doctor Who back in his life, it begs the question, why did Keith ever relinquish his hold on the official Doctor Who fan club?
It's a long gig, and I was knackered by the end of it, and also Graham Williams had taken over.
But with the recent publication of Keith's two-volume memoir of his time as the head of the only officially sanctioned Doctor Who fan organisation of the early 1970s, he no longer has to fight for his position in fandom, or indeed, for his position in the history of Doctor Who.
I had thought that my place in the Doctor Who story had been forgotten, but it's totally different now.
All these strange equations keep on running through my brain.
People talking, you know, about the fan club. In fact, I'm getting loads of people who want to join it now. And I say, well, sorry, something. Been out of commission for a few decades. It's quite nice to know that, you know, to re-establish a wee part of you as part of the Doctor Who story.
Oh, once life was so much simpler.
And speaking of stories, perhaps our favourite bit of everything that Keith did for Doctor Who was his pictorial recording of Doctor Who history in the form of his comic strip adaptations. What chance a recitation of his version of An Unearthly Child, in which all of the characters speak with the vernacular and worldview of a slightly shy Scottish teenager.
I'll get it back someday.
Coal Hill School at 4 o'clock. Two teachers meet in the corridor. Ian Chesterton and Barbara Wright.
Phew, glad that's over.
No more than I. Jones, stop running. Everyone's in a hurry these days. Though not quite everyone. Problem child, eh? No, not really. She's just strange, that's all. Like when I asked her where Japan was, she answered it was a county in Scotland. Yet she can give a detailed description of what Henry VIII liked for supper. She can be quite brilliant and yet come up with stupid answers like these. It's uncanny. I see what you mean. And when I offered to take her home one afternoon, she stopped me outside a condemned junkyard and got at. She didn't want me to see where she stayed. I only wish I had followed her.
Dispatched a shuttle for my return, so it is nearly time I took my leave of this TV cream podcast. But not before I bring you a preview of the next and final installment.
The meeting can now begin.
No,
a chance to know even. What's all this about?
This is Jeffrey from a 1970 Doctor Who story with the Silurians that I've been told to call Doctor Who and the Silurian.
I don't like it.
And just when it seemed about to sink under a tsunami of ginger hair and gingham, came this pair of bright barkers.
Rub-ti-tum, knock on the door.
While you were listening to that sequence, a spring, almost too tiny for human comprehension, has uncoiled in the base of my seat. Although it is of almost insignificant size, that pinprick of pain it is causing in my posterior is almost unconscionable. And as the Daleks do not possess sufficient appendages to remove the offending protrusion, I am consigned to this fate! Have pity on me!